welcome to our data center webinar. I am Chris Papa. I am the founding partner of Jackson Lucas. We're an executive search firm. We do a lot more than executive search. We do compensation consulting, organizational consulting, board work. We also have a part of our company that does partnerships with universities, which is called JL Access. We have our pilot with Georgetown University. They're working with us to expand their career services program. So we do a lot all around human capital and real estate. We have different other sections in investment banking and other alternative asset classes, but mainly the largest group we have is real estate. And Lisa Flicker, I'm based in the Bay Area, and Lisa Flicker here, she's my colleague and partner at the firm. She runs the real estate practice, and she's out in New York City. How you doing, Lisa?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. This is great. It's amazing how quickly data centers went from being like this very small niche thing that random clients would call about to like such a big part of our business.
Yeah, I remember I did digital realty searches with them 10 years ago, maybe, or something like that. And like, no idea what it was. Really no idea. And now
nobody wanted to take your call, probably.
Nobody wanted to be involved with it. And so we got some great experts in the data center world today. We have Christina Metzger. She is with CBRE. How you doing, Christina?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me, Chris.
My pleasure. And we also, I'm just going through across my screen here. David Guarino, he's with Green Street.
Hey, Chris.
How you doing? And Greg Berman's with Thor Equities.
Everybody.
And Rahul Chandiak is with GI Partners. So let's kind of go through a little bit about just each of your backgrounds and how sort of it relates to data centers, kind of your job. This way, then we can hop into the questions. So I don't know, Christina, if you want to start off just kind of how your role is related to data centers.
Sure, yeah. So I've been at CB now for 18 years, exclusively focused on the data center sector for the last 15. Really started my career out in all things data center, so site selection, acquisition, lease negotiation, and structuring, and capital markets. Over time, I've honed that in where now I lead a team of professionals that is exclusively focused on the data center sector in the capital market segment, so acquisition, disposition, recapitalization of data center assets across the United States.
Thank you. David?
Yeah, so Green Street's a commercial real estate research and data analytics firm. We cover all commercial property types across the globe, really. And my background's more on the traditional real estate side, but similar to what you were saying, Chris, is data center interest peaked in the last decade or so. We put more resources towards data centers, so I became the guy to cover the space. And now I cover data centers across the globe and towers as well for both our clients that invest on the public security side. So that'd be like a Digital Realty and Equinix. And also on the private market side. So some of the folks on the screen who buy assets, we're trying to help them figure out what they're worth, what valuations look like, where rent's going to go in the future, anything you'd want to know if you were going to invest in the space.
Awesome. Greg?
Greg Berman with Thor Equities. Thor is a $20 billion AUM global investor developer, got a division in Europe, US, and Mexico. In Europe, we're under construction on a data center that will likely become the largest data center in Spain. In the U.S., we acquired our first site last year. Our practice is run by a guy who was a former head of acquisitions at a major hyperscaler. And so we are, really boots on the ground acquiring sites. I lead our U.S. industrial platform, but just because industrial and data centers are so related, and that we were also already looking for power for manufacturing, I pivoted my time pretty heavily and am very focused on the data center space, including sourcing a lot of acquisitions for Thor.
Awesome. And Raul?
Sure. So I work at GI Partners, leading our real estate acquisitions team. For those who don't know, GI Partners started out over two decades ago with an initial equity commitment to invest at the intersection of technology and real estate. So we went out and we bought a bunch of data centers that were trading at a pretty nice discount to replacement cost on the heels of the dot-com bust, rolled that up into a company called Digital Realty, took it public. Now it's, you know, this big $50 billion REIT. Since then, we've continued to raise funds and invest across the risk spectrum from core to development, but specifically in the data center space and also in other technology-oriented uses like life sciences and mission-critical R&D.
We have a bunch of different perspectives here. Let's just start with a and thank you once again, Christina, for helping with this outline here. Let's just start with a sector overview. And this was directed at David. What is a data center in its most simplest form? Can you just kind of explain what we're talking about here when we say data centers?
Yeah, we'll keep it really high level. So, I mean, at the simplest form, I'd say that three main things a data center does, right? It's space, it's power, and it's cooling. So that's really what a data center is built for. And you can think of it as basically you're not going to know one driving from the outside unless you know what you're looking for. But picture just an industrial box, right? So kind of a faceless piece of real estate. Sometimes there might be some pretty design on the outside and some landscaping that goes with it. But really, it's going to be like any logistics or industrial facility. But what really differentiates it is the infrastructure that goes into it to give it that power and cooling aspect. So figure if you build an industrial box, that might be 20% of your total cost, then you layer on another 80% of the cost to put in cooling equipment and backup equipment and electrical equipment. There's a lot of physical infrastructure that goes in to make it a data center. Now, when we think about it, right, from a landlord perspective, landlords are typically responsible for building the cost of the shell and all those cooling and power components that go into it. And then they'll lease space to tenants who are going to come in and install computer servers and networking gear in the facility. But that's essentially what the data center is. It's basically how the internet functions. It's where everything we consume on our computers and phones lives. It's not floating in a cloud. It's a physical building. And, you know, the folks on the screen are responsible for a lot of what we do on a daily basis, right? The capital flows to those assets.
Is that actually a cloud? Is it shaped like a cloud? Is there something to do?
I haven't seen that design scheme yet. It's like if you had like a square cloud, right? Or a cube shaped cloud, then yes. But not the one you're envisioning with the rounded edges.
And who are you seeing as your primary occupants in the data centers?
So there's definitely a number of them, right? So you could think of every company on the screen and probably the ones that are in the audience as well, probably have data center space in some way. Though the vast majority of the space, we've kind of shifted our workloads to a handful of companies. And this has kind of been a global societal shift where we refer to them as hyperscale tenants. People kind of refer to them as the big tech companies, but your Amazons, your Googles, your Microsofts of the world, these are really the largest leasers and the largest tenants of data center space around the globe. And when you think about it, all of us utilize their services, right? We probably all have Microsoft hosting our emails or Amazon's hosting a website for us, or we use Salesforce, right, as a database for us. So those tend to be the largest users of data center space, but you have corporations and governments around the globe that also have needs for data center space. So it's really not one size fits all.
How has that changed over time? Like I remember we used to have a server room where I used to work, and like we wanted to do it all in house, and the server room would always overheat and all the computers wouldn't work. Is this kind of like, it's a data center, like I don't want the server room anymore. I don't want to take care of it. Like I'm moving it to a big box somewhere else. Someone else to take care of it.
That's a good Rahul question, right? With his investment in digital realty, I think he should take that one. He's got a good perspective, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think, you know, if you look at what data, so I've been at GI Partners for almost 10 years now. And I think when I first joined, we were buying these small, data centers that were leased to Amazon. And, you know, it was a diminished amount of power compared to how much they use today. We were able to buy them at 7 caps because nobody really understood what data centers were, but hey, we were getting Amazon credit at 7, so that worked. Back then, the compute, the amount of work that went into these facilities was materially less, right? I mean, if you look at Murphy's Law and kind of the expansion of technology over time, even over a short period, call it 10 years, these facilities have morphed into something completely different. So, you know, you had the wave of cloud computing where, you know, Chris, to your point, you know, instead of Bank of America having their own data center, they went ahead and started migrating to a cloud, you know, serviced facility by Amazon or Microsoft or Google, whoever it may be. And now, you know, the new advent is AI. which is another layer of computing that a lot of these big tech firms are chasing after. So it's really just this progression that's moved along with the technology sector as that's sort of grown and expanded beyond, you know, the simplicity of what was getting onto the internet back in the mid-90s to today, where you have so many different devices connected to the internet that can tell you everything about yourself that you didn't even realize, right? So I think as that kind of continues to grow, then the data center industry also will continue to expand and become, you know, even more than it is today.
So interesting. And I feel like when people talk to us about hiring in this sector in particular, they're all talking about like this future ready leadership. And so I'm wondering if you saw so much change from 5 or 10 years ago to now, what do you think we're in store for?
Another good question. It's hard to say. I would say that at the end of the day, you know, if you look at AI, for example, I mean, today it's very much a rudimentary tool, right? It's like, hey, ChatGPT, tell me what I can do in France for the next 2 weeks. I think as AI starts to, you know, become a more practical business application, as, you know, these AI deployments go from being more focused on learning and training, which is what these big, you know, hyperscale campuses are in the middle of nowhere, to more edge deployments or deployments within regional population centers that consumers are actually using, you'll start to see a bigger expansion beyond just these mega campuses. A good example is Netflix, right? So if you think about Netflix, the only way you can really access, you know, 4K Ultra HD movies at your fingertips is if Netflix deploys in your regional population center. You can't have a big giant Netflix box in Iowa and expect everyone to connect into it. It's impossible to service all those connections and also send the data from, you know, the middle of the country to the East Coast or the West Coast. So Netflix figured out, and not just Netflix, but Apple, Google, Amazon, they all figured out, okay, we've got to have smaller regional deployments. And so the internet became more decentralized, and that's kind of the next wave with AI, right? So AI deployments will start to go more towards the edge markets, towards these regional population centers. And that's kind of where the next, you know, sort of, you know, footprint of growth will probably occur over the next 5 years. But these bigger campuses are probably here to stay for some time.
Let's talk about the supply and demand of it, because like you said, Raul, when you were doing this, no one knew about it. You're doing 7 caps and... Greg, what are you, you're actively out there trying to source deals. What are you seeing as far as market rents are responding? How do you anticipate them over the next couple of years?
Well, first off, I think it's important to segment the market into, and Rahul kind of touched on this, but you've got edge, you've got co-location, you've got enterprise, and you've got hyperscale AI. You know, I think the stats should say the co-location rents have grown something like 50% since 2021. So there's some very strong rent growth in that segment. In the segment we play in, we're really doing built-to-suit campuses for hyperscalers. And so our metric is really yield on cost. And we're building, you know, a warm shell or a full fit out to a yield on cost figure. And I wouldn't say that we've actually seen those change dramatically over the past year. I think that what could change is that, of course, land, you know, powered land gets more expensive as we see just equipment costs get more expensive. And potentially if interest rates rise, you could see the effective, you know, numbers that hyperscalers are paying go up as those other cost components get higher. So there's kind of different pricing segments in the market. And we're seeing, you know, different areas are responding to.
Thanks. And Christina, what are you seeing as the current investor landscape for the data centers right now? You think investors' interest in data centers in general is going to continue to grow?
I do. Yeah. No, we see great depth of and diversity of liquidity across the risk spectrum in data centers. So on our bid sheets, as we look at, you know, highly opportunistic powered land all the way through stabilized core, there's great investor engagement. In the past couple of years, really the past 24 months, there's been a little bit of muted transactions on the core side simply because there haven't been a lot of captive sellers. The investor market is there on the acquisition side. There's just a little bit of a bid-ask spread. I think today, to Greg's point from Thor is we've seen a bit of a level set. You know, development yields have remained relatively constant. I think the general perception of market rates and where that is generally set at a certain mark. And groups are developing to a point today where they can exit and still hit their return profile. So if you think about all of the fundamentals within the sector, there's incredible new interest as they're pivoting out of more traditional asset types like office or maybe hotels or even multifamily in the current market conditions and into alternatives. And data centers being a huge beneficiary of that overall trend within the real estate sector. We put out an annual investor sentiment survey where we survey the largest global institutional investors. And in that survey from last year, we asked over 300 unique investors if they intended to increase, decrease, or remain the same in their allocation towards the data center sector. And I think 97% responded that they intended to increase the amount of investment into data centers. And then we asked them too, if you look at data centers as a percentage of assets under management, today, most all of them is less than 5%. So 0 to 5% of their overall portfolio. But when we ask them what they anticipate that to be in the next 5 to 10 years, the bulk majority moves between at a minimum 5 to 10%, if not greater. And each one of those percentage points is worth, you know, billions of dollars of total investment. So there's a tremendous amount of capital that's being allocated into the space. And that's something that we don't see changing for the foreseeable future, largely just given, you know, the property fundamentals are fantastic. You have historic levels of demand, record low supply, vacancies at an all-time low, less than 1% nationally in the way that CB tracks it. And the path and timeline to deliver new product only continues to lengthen, with most all of it being pre-leased. And so rents have gone up over time, and the underlying tenant credit in these contracts is very sound. You know, you have some of the most financially stable global institutions, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, that are signing on to 10, 15-year contracts. That it gives a lot of conviction and certainty within the sector, but it's very rosy for the foreseeable future. What happens, you know, 5 to 7 years from now, I don't think anyone on the phone knows exactly how that will shape, but in the current moment and market, great investor interest, great liquidity on both the credit and the equity side, and no signs of that changing.
Where are the top, I guess, David, you would have most purview into this, the top markets for data centers right now?
Yeah, so in the U.S., it's a little different than other, you know, commercial property types, right? Where every major market has every commercial property type. Data centers have kind of clustered together in just a handful of markets. So Northern Virginia is by far the largest and most important data center market, just outside of D.C. But just to rattle off a few more, so Atlanta, Dallas, Chicago, Phoenix, Silicon Valley, Northern New Jersey area, those are some of the hot spots. Now, there are some growing markets, right? It's kind of Christina was hinting at the challenge we have and why the sector is so interesting right now is we've got this massive demand-supply imbalance where there's just so much demand, but we can't build enough supply. And it's not that we can't get enough generators and enough, right, steel to put up the walls. It's simply we can't get enough power from utility providers. So we're actually seeing this shift happen outside those primary markets. And we're seeing secondary markets emerge and start to become more like primary markets. So Columbus, Ohio is an interesting one. 5 years ago, I don't think anybody on the screen would have said, keep your radar on that. But that market is gaining traction. Salt Lake City has become an interesting market. Austin has become an interesting market. So you're starting to see these areas pop up where essentially they can find power in a quick timeline and you can get data centers built. So there's a shift happening for sure. Is it ever going to be like other core property types where you have every food group and every major market? Probably not, simply because data centers, you don't just plop them anywhere. You have to have the fiber infrastructure as well. Connectivity really matters because we don't want to wait for our Netflix video to load. We want it to be there as quick as possible. So we're probably going to see that continuing cluster effect happen, but definitely there's a broadening number. So I'd say we probably track 8 to 10 primary data center markets in the U.S. If you included maybe what you'd call secondary markets, you could push that number up to 20. But it's a growing number for sure.
Why is D.C. the highest? The government, just all the backup there, or all the data?
Yeah, I mean, historically, you had the internet kind of started. If we go back to like the 70s, it was a pseudo government project.
Al Gore, right? Didn't he start it?
Say it again.
Al Gore started the internet.
That's the rumor. Yeah, he gets the credit for it. Now there were some groups before that, but you had a lot of infrastructure go in there, and you know it's actually a good location in general. Like data centers, you need cheap power costs, you need connectivity, but low natural disaster risk is another good one. So you don't really have a lot of risks that you have like in Northern California. You've got wildfires, right? In New York, we saw with Superstorm Sandy, you've got basements that can flood and ruin your IT infrastructure. So there's just issues around the world, but DC really kind of gravitated, and then you had a lot of tech firms go in there, and the state of Virginia has done a really good job in courting in the industry. So it's almost, I think of it as like it's this flywheel effect where you had some data centers get built, and then fiber providers came in, and because there was more fiber, you had more data center companies come in, and then that brought more fiber, and on and on and on, and it just kind of grew on itself from there.
Makes sense. I heard somebody say the other day that the Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of stones. And this thought that eventually that the, that maybe there might be a different need for data and power. But I don't know. We could all guess on that. But I wanted to just ask Greg real quickly, have the site selection guidelines changed in recent years? What have you been seeing?
Yeah, I mean, and David, you know, referred to some of this. I mean, historically, data centers clustered in the same areas because of some of those factors, but also because of redundancy. It was really a lot of data centers, you saw pairs of three to make sure that they had, you know, full levels of redundancy. And so it was really important to be in those same locations. Now with AI, because so much of the workload, I think the stat is about 75% is training and 25% is what's called inferencing, which is when you're actually putting the search in or the task into the AI. And the 75% training, latency is not nearly as important, and theoretically neither is redundancy. So because of that, it has made the location of the data centers right now a bit less critical to be near those clusters. So, you know, that's why you're seeing a lot of markets that used to not be on the radar. Suddenly, you know, you're seeing big data center campuses pop up in those markets. And there's, you know, quite a number of places across the U.S. we're seeing that. The other criteria, though, that is changing is that the end user clients, they still want to be able to potentially have a cloud zone in those areas. So they're still looking at bigger campuses. So, you know, we're looking for sites generally 200 to 300 plus acres in some of these markets. Some of the big hyperscalers now are looking for 500 plus acre sites. So it's changed the nature of what folks are looking for and where they're looking. And to also that note, historically data centers wouldn't consider going into any areas that might have any chance of a natural disaster. And now we're seeing more instances of, if there's a very unusually large power load, hyperscalers being willing to go to certain areas they wouldn't have before to access that power. So just like any other asset class, when you see demand really explode, people will generally change their, you know, sort of lower their criteria as to where they have to be to meet that demand.
Gotcha. And what about, Rahul, some of the regulations now in all these different areas? And like, are they, is there like a wild west out there as far as when you can do, or different municipalities? Like, wait, you can't suck all my energy away, or you can't build this here? Like, it's, what's going on out there on the regulation side?
There's a little bit of that. And ironically, a lot of it's happening in Northern Virginia, where you have, you know, the traditional large counties that used to service a lot of these data centers now pushing back and saying, yeah, I think we have enough. You know, we need to start building multifamily. We need to build more residential communities. We need to have a more diversified, you know, tax base, right? And so So there's a bit of that that I think is happening more so in some of the major markets that David mentioned. Interestingly, though, there are markets out there that are going in the opposite direction. Minnesota is a great example. Minnesota is offering tax incentives to the end users, the Apples, the Googles, to come in there. They're saying, hey, look, for 20 years, we won't charge you sales tax on any of your servers or other equipment that you're putting into these facilities. And those are hundreds of millions of dollars, right, that they don't have to pay tax on. So they're incentivizing groups to come into markets that traditionally weren't data center markets. And if you look at Chicago, which is the big Midwestern hub, vacancy there is, I mean, David will tell you, it's like sub 2%. And power is probably not going to get there for at least another 4 to 5 years. So Minnesota all of a sudden becomes a really interesting and attractive place to go. And so Amazon's putting their availability zones, which is, you know, basically a key sort of gateway for their machine learning and training. Meta's already there. There's plenty of other groups that are coming into Minneapolis and surrounding suburbs. So you do have some municipalities actually trending in the opposite direction where they're saying, hey, we actually like this and we like the tax revenue that's generated off of these assets and all of this is a net positive. So we're going to go ahead and lean into it.
Oh, interesting.
Minnesota, huh?
Minnesota.
That's right.
Christina, what types of investment opportunities are you currently seeing? I feel like people are definitely interested in hearing what's out there.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of diversity. So I think what's interesting about the data center sector and Raul and team definitely commented on this, is there's really not a ton of speculative development in the current market. So most everything before the developers are going vertical has been pre-leased, and that the capitalization sort of taking place in parallel. So highly opportunistic investors are either fully integrated or where they've moved is more into like the powered shell or the powered land segment of the market. So as we talked about, the ability to access power is driving new demand into new markets and locations. The timeline to procure power is also lengthening. And so there are real estate investors that are focusing on just that segment of the industry, many of them coming out of the industrial sector, where, you know, they've got great experience in putting together large parcels of land and then working with the utility to drive forward the power. And then they're positioning that to the data center developer, which it works out well, because for many of these data center closed-end funds, as you can imagine, might be a 7 or even a 10-year fund life. If it takes you 4 years just to get the land and the entitlements and the power, it's difficult to then also develop the data center site, lease it to the user, and make it work. So it's a very efficient market. So I'd say that's kind of the opportunistic segment of the market today. And there's a lot of opportunity there. That segment of the market, though, I would describe as the Wild West, just in that barriers to entry are low. Overall data center expertise is a little lighter. You know, it's really focused on land and power. And so many, I'm sure those on the call and others in the industry, are eager to evaluate their own portfolios to identify if there's a higher and better use for data center. And I would say for every 100 that come across my desk, less than 5 actually work, because they lack the scale reference on the call. From there, you kind of move up. In the development side, you know, most of that is pre-lease, so taking a bit of a different profile. A little bit of value add, although candidly not a tremendous amount of value add in the data center sector. What you tend to see is more of a barbell approach. You have a lot of development or opportunistic powered land, and then a lot of core. And so the core plus segment of the market, as we think about it, tends to be data center assets that are leased to non-investment grade tenants. So whether that be on the powered shell side, like a Flexential or Center Square, and on the turnkey side, maybe it's a CoreWeave or an AI integrator that is the occupant in that facility. So the sort of the non-core nature of it typically is more the credit profile of the tenant. And then into the core segment of the market, you know, a lot of existing core products. Whether or not that will move or not, you know, we've had sellers somewhat on the sidelines in the core segments of the market, but I think you'll see that materially change this year. You know, long-term lease, a lot of it net lease with fixed annual indexes to, you know, Google, Microsoft, and Amazon. So very core in overall.
This would be amateurish, but I have to ask it quickly. Is if you're valuing an asset for another client, for not data centers, like a hotel or an office building, do you now look at the underlying land to see if there's a power play there?
Many are. The challenge really comes in the power. The idea that there are just sites out there with a ton of power sitting available, I think, is far-fetched. Candidly, maybe a couple of years ago, you may have found pockets of opportunity within given geographies where there was a lot of excess capacity, and say most of that has been absorbed. The sites that tend to be the best conversion opportunities typically come out of the industrial sector. So maybe there's like a heavy manufacturing use. There's already an on-site existing substation that can be upgraded. The zoning is already, you know, heavy manufacturing and data center is approved by right. You know, things that make it a little easier to advance the ball towards ultimate data center delivery. Data centers, we talked about, Raul did a little bit, some of the challenges in legislation and in some markets relative to new development. You know, they're not typically located within close proximity to residential, just simply they have generators, which create noise and have emissions. And so moving residential or multifamily to data centers is probably not viable. Hotels as well, you know, they're in more of a downtown metropolitan type area typically. You know, it'd be really just land value that you're looking at for that redevelopment. I think industrial the one that's been the most natural progression, but most all data centers are, you know, purpose-built state-of-the-art facilities. There's really not a lot of retrofits or conversions.
So I was hoping to knock down some apartment buildings for the data center.
Under my house, I'd find power. It would be amazing.
I want to oil something. Yeah, I mean, you know, with what Christina said about the power, you know, because realistically, a huge amount of my job is spent really looking for power. And there's some interesting things going on. Right now, I mean, we've seen the queues when you find a site, you submit a power study, you get put to a queue, and the queues for power have gotten enormously long. I think I'd heard like in Texas, there's something like requests for 100 gigawatts or something in the queue, just something insane. And the reality is, though, is that a huge amount of those requests in the queue are really been submitted by land speculators that really know very little about data centers. And we've heard from some of the power companies that up to 80% of the requests in the queue aren't real, where it's, you know, it's a group that doesn't have the ability to execute on the data center. They don't have the ability to write a $20 million check for a power commitment. The site might, you know, theoretically be 300 acres, but it's crossed by a road, it's crossed by power lines, it's crossed by gas lines. You can't build a contiguous campus. I mean, we've seen a lot of sites like that that had been offered to us. And so it is like the powered land segment of the market is the Wild West right now. And I think over the next, you know, year or two, that'll start to get a little bit clearer. We're certainly seeing a lot of power companies start to make folks submit financials, submit affidavits, submit a lot of information to really weed out who's real and who's not. So I do think that'll present an interesting opportunity for the players out there that have the ability to actually execute and have the expertise to, be able to show the power companies that they are, you know, they're a real customer or they're going to bring a real customer.
Now we talked about the land, we talked about the power. What about the cap markets? All these other asset classes, it's hard to make things pencil, yada, yada, yada. What do they look like in the data center world? I guess we have the vice chair of data center capital markets from CBRE on the call. So would you like to field that one, Christine?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about just the investment opportunities across the risk spectrum and kind of what those look like. And I think really, if you look at data centers, there's great liquidity on both the credit and the equity side. So different than other product types where I think there's been a little bit more of a constrained debt capital markets. And data centers, we've benefited from the fact that it's classified as more than just real estate. So you see investors from infrastructure, you know, project finance, TMT, and real estate investors that one of the greatest benefits to the data center space today is just the ample liquidity in the debt market, candidly, and the creativity and structure that's available. And I think it's really unique when you contrast it to, like, you know, more traditional food groups like office, industrial, retail, even though we're seeing, you know, 100% financing solutions, because the underlying, again, very distinct from data centers, is so much of the product is 100% pre-leased to Google, Microsoft, Amazon on a 15-year basis. And so there's some incredible opportunities for investment on the credit side. But then the creativity and the structures and that optionality creates more opportunity too on the equity side. And so, Greg, I know you guys are very active in large-scale build-to-suits for hyperscalers. Maybe you can just touch on how the availability of you know, debt financing has changed maybe part of this strategy or the way that you guys are looking at investment in this.
Yeah, I mean, the debt is, I think somebody had made a comment earlier, because these loans are underwritten by some of the best credit on the planet, there's quite a bit of debt financing available at very attractive rates on the build-to-suits. And so, you know, that certainly follows with, on the equity side, that once you've got a hyperscale lease signed, there's a tremendous number of groups very interested in funding equity for those deals. I think the area, though, where there's less liquidity is more in the early stage powered land space, especially for real estate investors. It's harder to get your arms around, because you're really bleeding into infrastructure. You're going to be funding things like power commitments. You're going to be funding, this land play that, you know, candidly, there's not nearly the depth of comps, right? Like if I say, what does this industrial land trade for in the Atlanta MSA, I can give, you know, 100 comps and we can get a pretty good precision on what that land should trade for. Powered land, not only are there less comps, there's also a lot more factors of, like, how far are you from the, you know, from the 345 line? What's your infrastructure going to cost? There's a lot of other factors to consider. So there's, you know, we're seeing increasing equity investors in that space, but I'd say there's less that are, like, easily identifiable in the space when you've gotten that full hyperscale lease signed. But, you know, likewise, debt in that space is available, but it's, you know, certainly higher octane rates. You're not at that point when you have a hyperscale lease signed. So if you're going to require land for that, you are looking at debt that's more, you know, bridge debt kind of terms. So it's a lot riskier. So you've got, you know, it's a little bit of a barbell, where on one hand you've got very inexpensive capital, incredible credit. On the other hand, it's a lot more risk and a little bit harder to figure out what the, you know, how to box into that risk.
You know, it's interesting. We've seen a fair amount of our clients merge their infrastructure with their real estate businesses. And I assume this is kind of the underlying cause of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, really, really, that's what a lot of fundamentally you're doing, is investing in infrastructure with these plans.
Interesting. So I'm going to throw out a question to Rahul. As data center developments increase in size and move to more remote locations, are capitalizations being impacted in any way? And we may have answered this a little bit before, but I'm just wondering.
I think the short answer is yes. It's a little bit hard to say now, because to Christina's earlier point, you know, there is a bit of fervor on both the debt and equity capital market side for the data center space. So I think you are seeing really large campuses get securitized with financing at really impressive spreads, that to the point where it almost doesn't really matter what the location of the market is. It's, you know, if you've got a brand new purpose-built data center, a lease that's 15 years old or longer, and it's leased to an investment-grade entity, then, yeah, great, you're going to get 150 to 200 over. So there is a lot of, so I guess the short answer is I haven't personally really seen a big change. I think what will be interesting to see, though, is down the road, do these big campuses train at the same cap rates as a smaller, you know, facility in a major market, right? So does a 1 gigawatt campus train at the same cap rate as a 50 megawatt facility in Ashburn, Virginia, My personal opinion is it doesn't, because that's a bigger check to write. It's not a core or gateway market. And 50 megawatt, you know, facility leased to Google or Amazon in a gateway market is probably a little bit easier to wrap your arms around if you're, you know, the average investor looking at data centers. So time will tell what happens down the road. But I think as of today, it's not a bad, you know, time to be in the sector, whether you're on the equity or the debt side. I mean, the other part of it too, that I would also say, you know, the debt notes are being underwritten by investment banks and ratings agencies, groups that are not necessarily sophisticated in data centers. So there is a bit of an informational, you know, gap or even potential arbitrage opportunity where if you are sophisticated enough and you understand the nuance, you can potentially take advantage of that. So it's not necessarily as straightforward and rosy as it may seem, but there's certainly money that's interested in the space. And it could also be partly because the other major food groups are not necessarily as exciting to talk about today.
Yeah, it's nice to have the infrastructure. Does that go ahead, Christine?
I was just going to add on real quick, you know, something that we're seeing and we're kind of advising on our clients is as these overall capitalizations are growing so large so quickly, right, with the end users, is that rather than do a single build-to-suit for a client that might be like a $2 billion capitalization in one asset, we're advising our clients, and we're seeing this take place. And I know, Greg, you guys are a great example of it. Do a campus deployment, right? So there might be, instead of one very large building, you know, five smaller buildings on a larger campus environment, each asset sitting on its own parcel with its own lease. And by doing that, yes, you could sell it all in one go at $2 billion hypothetically, but it gives you much greater optionality and flexibility in the overall capitalization on both the front and the back end, where size is absolutely a consideration in the current market conditions. You know, 5 years ago, the bigger the better, right? There was the larger the transaction, the tighter it traded. Today, as we have seen, you know, cost of capital increase, particularly more in like the CMBS market, which has been, you know, the predominant vehicle for some of these large takeouts, the all-in cost of financing for a single, you know, $2 billion transaction is wider than something you might get at like $500 million, where you're able to get a life company to step up and even much tighter spread. So I think the change in value or overall cap rate as a reflection of not necessarily location, but of size. And so you're just starting to see a little bit of a bifurcation in the investor and the developer and how they're approaching the space. And some of those really large transactions where you may have a single tenant, single building, the one user that's worth, you know, a couple $1 billion, those are probably better served for the public market, right? Or there's some form of like a club vehicle potentially, because it is very difficult for traditional real estate capital to have so much concentration in a single tenant, in a single location, and in a single building. So I think that's an important piece of the puzzle. And then David, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to kind of bring in that comment real quick.
No, that's right along the lines of what I was going to get at. It's nice to have the infrastructure crowd invested in this space. If you go back a few years, right, it was traditionally the real estate folks that are what data centers fell into it. They checked the REIT wrapper for IRS definitions, so people kind of grouped them as real estate. But I think when the infra crowd started to see how much capital is required and how lucrative the returns are, it opened up this new wave of capital that was much needed in the sector. Kind of Ro was saying, it'd be interesting to see where these big portfolios end up trading. The interesting part is, I mean, why there's so much capital going into data centers is the returns on development are just fantastic. If you look at any other commercial property type, your development returns are 20 to 30% on average. Data centers are two times, maybe even three times higher than that, depending on the land. So when you think about the check sizes we're talking about, billions of dollars of deployments and 50, 60% development profit margin, there's a tremendous amount of capital to be made. And even if you're wrong on the exit cap rate by, you know, 50 or 100 basis points, that's still a pretty phenomenal return relative to any other commercial property type you could invest in. So I think hence why you have so much optimism going into the sector.
I want to skip ahead here because I want to get to some listener questions soon and try to get us out of here at a reasonable time. I wanted to talk about, we talked a lot about power, but what is the, ESG is a part of people's investment strategy, especially like more of the European investors, like, and I'm sure, you know, power requires a lot of, I assume right now, a lot of fossil fuels. Like, what is the ESG impact of a data center, and like, how is that affecting people's investment decisions into this space? Or some like Canadian or European investors like constrained? They see the ESG and they're not able to invest in it.
I think Raul is probably given his overall history of investing in the asset. I think that's serving lens, and then we can all probably chime in.
Who are you going out to get money? Who's giving you money, Raul?
Everybody.
We everybody, Chris. There's no, you know, territory we haven't covered. Let's put it that way. I would say you'd be surprised how ESG focused the data center industry itself has become. Certainly, just even in the past 5 years, especially the end users too. A good example is Christina sold us a building a couple of years ago, and that tenant, you know, has a water loop running through the building that uses recycled water, right? And they've got plenty of other sort of, emission reducing strategies and procedures within their own facility. You have other data center users who are also looking to get away from diesel generators, which are, you know, big pollutants whenever they're actually turned on, to focusing more on lithium batteries, right? I mean, that's still sort of early days, but it gives you a sense for how the tenants are pushing, you know, the boundaries and trying to become more green, because it's ultimately in the ethos of a lot of these big tech companies. So, you know, from a capital market standpoint, I think we've been able to be a part of, you know, organizations like GRESB, for example, which is sort of leading the charge for real estate, you know, ESG. It has been for decades now. And that bodes well with a lot of our LPs, especially those that are in Europe and other parts of the world that are focused on ESG. So we've been able to, you know, curate a portfolio of assets that actually shows really well to ESG conscious investors. And I think as the data center industry becomes more sophisticated, more nuanced, you're going to see a lot more, you know, don't call it a fully green data center or like a LEED Platinum data center, but I mean, we have assets in our portfolio, like the JV that we did with Digital Realty in 2023. I mean, those assets are all LEED Silver. One of them is even LEED Gold. So, you know, there is a path towards, you know, having ESG-friendly facilities in your portfolio.
It's awesome to hear.
So also going to mention quickly two other points. You know, when we're talking with our, you know, the end users that Raul mentioned, power mix is still very important to them. And they are looking, you know, certainly locations that have a higher mix of carbon-free, including nuclear, is definitely a bonus. And we're also doing site selection. If there is a big renewable play, you know, nearby where we can say we're going to pull from the solar field, that's another big bonus for a site selection perspective. And I'd say third is that while renewables generally can't provide baseload power now, there's a lot of battery tech developing, which you know, some of which at some point may be cost competitive with fossil fuel. So it is a big focus for the industry to figure out how to get to carbon-free power down the road.
Awesome. Oh, Lisa's, can't hear you, Lisa.
Sorry. I used to watch this political talk show and they would always end with future predictions, and I thought it was pretty exciting. So would love to ask each of you if you have any future predictions for the opportunity moving forward.
David?
Carol, I would say it's very good. I mean, we're thinking, again, from a commercial real estate lens, so relative to other property types, I would say there's no more sector we're more optimistic on. I would say rent growth is going to be very, very good over the next few years. As long as this supply-demand imbalance persists, we'll probably be in the high single-digit rate per year in terms of rent growth. Vacancy, 1%, probably what every market's moving to. It's going to be tough to find space, so there'll be a lot of new construction needed. And, you know, longer term, as we go 10, 15 years out, there's certainly question marks, right? And Chris kind of started off saying, hey, 20 years ago, data center was in my basement. And while I think that's always going to be a risk that plagues the sector, I would say if you look at the behavior of the smartest technology companies in the world, right, the Microsofts, the Googles, the Amazons, they're not signing 5 and 7 year leases like they used to. They're signing longer leases that are 10, 15, even 20 years in some cases. So it's interesting that the smartest technology companies in the world are suggesting traditional data centers are the way of the future. So I think that's a pretty strong vote of confidence for, yeah, I don't know if rent growth grows 10% per year for the next 20 years, I would probably say no, but the sector is certainly going to be around and the fundamentals are really, really attractive right now.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I think there's a really great opportunity to buy core products if you can get it. We talked about how the cost to develop has increased dramatically over the last 2 to 3 years. And if you look forward, that cost to develop is only increasing as well. And as a result, rental rates have gone up astronomically through that time period. And so there's a lot of product that's leased today at, you know, 50% below market for 15 years to very high credit tenants. That in the all-in basis, you're below replacement cost of what it would be to develop. And so I think there's a tremendous opportunity on the buy side right now from a capital markets perspective. Obviously, development, if you can get in front of the right development opportunity, I think there's a lot of, there's great opportunity there as well. But core, too, I think is something that has been overlooked in the last couple of years and now is really starting to jump off the page, particularly as there's some very creative debt financing available.
Let's go to the Q&A section here. Let's start with a question. We'll try to get through as many as we can. This is anonymous attendee. He or she wants to be kept secret. Maybe one of you four, I'm not sure. What's your view on the future of urban data centers? Do you see a trend of smaller scale data centers moving into city centers? I always think like, or I hear like, oh, we got all these empty office buildings. Why don't we turn them into data centers? And it feels like everything technology-based gets smaller and smaller. Is that going to be able to happen with data centers?
I mean, I think it's early, right? The use cases today are not that prevalent. And we kind of touched on it before, but power is the number one challenge. Can you get a couple megawatts of power into a urban office building? Not always. It's still a tremendous amount of power going into the facility. So I think it's the use cases will have to come before the investment comes. I always kind of compare it to, you know, taking cues from other property types, the apartment space versus the single family rental space, right? Apartments, you have 200 units in one building and all the components look the same. It's easy to maintain. And everyone thought they could replicate that with single family rental early on, but they quickly learned every house has, you know, a different sink or different, the electrical panels on a different part of the house. So it was just operationally intensive to do. And that's one of the challenges, I think. A 30 megawatt data center with an operation team is much different than 15 2-megawatt data centers scattered around the city. So I think that's a thought that is starting to see some trends adopted today, but we're very early on. And I think that's probably years away before that meaningfully takes off, if it does. That's my opinion. Somebody might disagree.
I do think that, though, there's going to be a lot of demand for edge data centers just because of the, you know, some of the things we touched on, you know, content delivery, Internet of Things, driverless cars, you know, just, you know, living in the Bay Area and taking Waymo, they're coming. You know, as things like virtual reality become more in use, I think there will be a lot of demand for low latency, you know, almost like a last mile delivery from an industrial perspective. So I do think there's a good you know, use case for that. Again, it's not a segment that we play in as much, so I can't speak as much to the economics and the operational intensity of those, but I think the demand cases are coming.
All right, let's go to the next one here from Patrick Roach. You want to ask that one, Lisa?
Sure. Could any of the panelists touch on what is to come in quantum computing? This is a tough aspect to wrap my head around. Basically see it as one of the unknowns and how much power and megawatts of power will be needed in the future. Anyone want to take a crack at it?
You're a nerd expert here.
I'm not an expert on it, but I had the same question myself and did some research on this topic. It's not clear that it would actually reduce the power usage because apparently all the infrastructure around the quantum chips itself uses a tremendous amount of electricity. So it's it's not at the moment clear that, to me that, because I had the same concern about, you know, anytime you're in industry, what are the threats to my industry? And from the research I did, it didn't seem that it was likely to dramatically reduce power needs.
Gotcha. Yeah, I would kind of say it's one of those out there risks for the sector, right? Maybe a decade plus away, but we kind of said in the beginning, space, power, and cooling are the most important things for a data center. And if you look at the activity with their pocketbooks, all of the big hyperscale tenants are voting for traditional data centers with the longest leases they've ever signed in the history of the sector. That kind of tells you maybe quantum computing has some merit, but no one is willing to bet on it today. They're betting on the way things are, and they're doing it in a very large way. So I think that's a pretty strong vote of confidence that it's next decade's problem, if it comes about.
Talk about Kerry Wallenkamp as a question here. Is someone looking transferred from residential commercial real estate development to data center development, location is always the first step in due diligence and project planning. Data centers are typically mission critical facilities. Is there a push to move more locations into the Midwest and away from East and West Coast due to natural disasters? I assume Kerry's never seen The Wizard of Oz. Is there a push to move away from, natural disasters on or environmental risks on the coasts?
I can take that one. I mean, I think the punchline is yes. At the same time, there's also a need to move to, you know, markets that traditionally weren't data center markets, partly because of access to power, and then also because, you know, to Greg's point, at some point you've got to get the ultimate product to the end user. And there's plenty of people who live in the Midwest. So, you know, you've got to build facilities. You have to build, you know, interconnection hubs. You have to build network hubs in all these regions so that, you know, folks aren't forced to, you know, use Elon's Stargate to access the internet, right? So it's just sort of a natural progression where, kind of going back to Murphy's Law, right? If it can't happen, it will. So I think it's just a matter of time before these markets start to become recipients of more data centers, more power, more compute over the near term.
Thank you. And now we have a question from Allison Waldman. Will there be enough opportunity to meet capital demands in the years ahead, or will that powder stay dry?
It's a great question. You know, the question we get more often is there enough capital for all the data centers that are being developed and need to exit. But if you actually look at it, at the amount of capital that's been allocated to this space over the last couple of years versus what has actually been spent, there has been far greater capital allocated than been utilized in many instances. So we touched on it throughout our conversation. There are many ways to invest in the data center sector, whether that's direct into assets through me or through the fund of GI, through Raul as an example, or in partnership with Thor Equities. I think that we'll continue to see more opportunity and opportunities of scale. So,
well, everyone, there's a lot of questions here. Usually we don't have this many, but people are very interested in this topic. So if you have a question here in the Q&A and it's not answered, please just email it to me or message it to me on LinkedIn if you don't know my email, and I'll make sure the folks here will get it and they can answer it, and I'll send it back to you. So let's just close with another one. Let's close from Rohan Arcutt, the last one here. How do you access the risk of obsolescence for a buyer of a recently developed data center when selling in 5 to 10 years? For example, liquid-cooled chips have already dramatically impacted data center design. Will there be takers for 10-year-old data centers in the future?
So I think a misconception that some have when investing in the data center sector is understanding the bifurcation on what the landlord owns and then what the tenant owns. If you look at the main components of development from a landlord perspective, even for turnkey products, many of those improvements have a fairly long useful life, right? Of generators, chillers, you know, those are long life assets and the technology there really hasn't changed dramatically over time. I think where we've seen the greatest shift and transformation has been on some of the shorter term products, which is like UPSs or batteries. Many of that now today, the users are doing, have their own proprietary systems that they're overseeing, managing, replacing, you know, with in-rack solutions. So the short answer is we sell data centers that are 5, 10, 15 years old all the time. I think you're underwriting through that operating cash flow to understand what is the needed replacement and overall capital spend over the investment horizon. And that's very much informing your investment price. But they're completely liquid, particularly when you have amount of power, right? So that power is really the asset. So the access to the power for future development as we retrofitted for users as needed to be moving forward. I think where we've seen the greatest challenges with obsolescence over time have been, I would say, in today's market, in scale. So scale is a big piece of the puzzle. You know, data centers 15 years ago were maybe a couple megawatts, and today we're seeing 100 megawatt plus type of deployments. It can sometimes be difficult for those smaller facilities to be competitive in the market today, as a lot of the fixed operating costs for a facility are the same, no matter if you're a 5-megawatt data center or 50-megawatt data center. So incremental cost per kilowatt that you're leasing is much greater on a smaller scale. Additionally, in floor loading and then in clear height. So floor loading, as facilities over time, you've got more compute capacity per square foot. That requires more equipment per square foot. It's now heavier per square foot. You have to have the infrastructure to be able to support it. They also create more heat. So you need to have the ability for the air to dissipate and have a greater spread in what that floor to ceiling clear height is, which has become tricky for maybe retrofit legacy office type buildings that weren't really developed for the weight and the heat that's being produced today. But new facilities that are largely single story or in some instances multi-story, depending on the overall location, but they're being developed to support the weight of the equipment and of the heat that's being generated. And I don't know if Rahul, your portfolio, I mean, you've acquired assets, you know, that are easily 15 years old and done quite well on them. Any observations that you have?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, there are even some assets in our portfolio that, you know, we've deemed are not strategic to own any longer and we're selling. It doesn't mean they're bad data centers, but it's just not where our focus is going forward. I think another thing I'd add to Christina's list is connectivity. So being able to connect back to one of the major internet hubs, which, going back to a previous question about will data centers go into city centers, you do have major, you know, they call them carrier hotels because they basically host the internet for a particular part of the country. So in Chicago, it's 350 Cermak in South Chicago. In the Southwest, it's One Wilshire, which is an asset we own. In the Pacific Northwest, it's the Westin Building. In Dallas, it's the Infomart. In Northern Virginia, there's actually plenty of assets, but Bowmead Circle in Northern Virginia is a big network hub as well. So, you know, these network hubs, if you connect back to them, they serve as the internet backbone for, you know, millions of people. If you can connect back to them, then you've got a great story to mitigate your obsolescence risk as well. And we've seen that, you know, time and time again. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the facilities that Greg is building are not able to persist, you know, beyond time and space, but having that connectivity story is important as well.
Well, Christina, Greg, Raul, David, thank you for your connectivity story. I don't know if that makes sense, but thank you for coming on the webinar. Thank you, Zoe Fonzo, who's running everything behind the scenes. And thank you, Lisa Flicker, for being a great other host today.
This was great. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Resume, a Jackson Lucas podcast, where we take a deep dive into the career journeys of some of the top minds in real estate and equip you with the knowledge to move forward in your path towards the success you've envisioned. Make sure to like, share, and subscribe to Beyond the Resume. Be grateful for your support. All episodes of Beyond the Resume are brought to you by Jackson Lucas, building inclusive and diverse businesses through talent acquisition. Visit us at jacksonlucas.com